Hello, and welcome to Ask Dr. Dawn. The opinions expressed in this program are those of the speakers, and this is a program intended for education and entertainment. It should not be construed as a substitute for a medical consultation. We'll be discussing health economics. There were a couple of stories this week that I thought you'd find interesting. And then we'll talk about new and scary info about dormant cancer cells. But first, I want to read to you a very poetic elegy. The setting is a medical school anatomy class after the final exam. Waves of relief and bottles of beer are passing around, and the students toast their teachers, each other, and finally one steps forward and says the following. In 2 months, my lab group has both come to know this man more intimately than anyone before us, and at the same time, we know nothing at all. I've seen the way his vocal cords stretched across his larynx. Whereas I can only imagine such a detail in my wife, my soulmate, and the mother of my children. Yet, I do not have the slightest idea of the sound of his voice. Information I receive freely from hundreds of passing strangers each day. I have traced the path his children took before their lives officially began. But I will never know him as a father. I have discovered firsthand how the tension of his flexor digitorum profundus curls his fingers. But I will never know his touch, whether it evokes fear, calm, or longing. And I have held his brain, seen the distinct grooves of his cerebral cortex, observed the curvature from where his dreams originated. But I will never know his thoughts, and the only dreams we share are mine. In 2 months, I thoroughly disassembled what took either eons of evolution to mold, or no less than an omnipotent intelligence to design, and saw for myself the what. In comparison, 8 decades of imperfect, fragile human life seem minuscule. Yet I couldn't even scratch the surface of the who. Thank you, whoever you are, for your donation. I still think about anatomy lab. It's a profound experience to confront death and stare at it for several hours every afternoon and touch it and peel it back and look beneath. They don't do it that way anymore. I think it's all or mostly pre-dissected, and it's a lot of models. I think they've missed something in taking away standard anatomy classes. But of course, I would think so. I learned so much there. How can I compare? So let's move on. Health economics. It's been said that unregulated monopolies never go well for the public. Well, hospital monopolies are driving up the cost of your health care. More than 1 million times a year, a surgeon slices open a knee, strips out worn cartilage, caps the leg bones with metal, and drops in a plastic spacer to allow the new joint to glide. But while these knee replacement procedures have become standard, the prices charged are anything but. For example, at Catawba Valley Medical Center in Hickory, North Carolina, the cost of the procedure under a Blue Cross Blue Shield health plan this year was about $16,000. According to data from Serif Health, a San Francisco startup that collects recently released data from hospitals and insurers. That's Serif Health, in case you wanted to look them up. Little more than an hour's drive east, however, in Asheville, North Carolina, at Mission Hospital, the cost of the procedure under the same plan is about $40,000. $16,000, $40,000, 1 hour's drive. Mission Hospital is a case study. Formed by the merger of the two largest hospitals in the region, Mission has little competition and more power to demand a higher price. Hospital price hikes mean that patients and their insurers must pay for more for an episode of healthcare, but it doesn't stop there. When insurers are faced with higher hospital prices, they pass the cost on and raise the prices they charged for everyone's health insurance. For many years, it was difficult to determine how much hospital monopolies boosted charges, but since 2021, The Center for Medicare and Medicaid Services has required hospitals to disclose prices, making it possible to gather comprehensive and comparative data for procedures. This is brand new, and it is going to go a long way to creating pushback on a quote-unquote market healthcare system that is anything but free market. Lots of hospitals, and I won't list them, charge twice as much as a neighboring hospital. What matters really is how many independent hospitals are competing with each other in an area. From 2002 to 2020, there were more than 1,000 hospital mergers unfolded in the United States. And what the data shows pretty clearly is that when hospitals have bargaining leverage, they tend to have higher prices. Over the last quarter century, hospital prices have risen faster than those for any other economic sector, and hospital consolidation is one of the primary drivers. Now, federal and state officials have flip-flopped over whether to intervene. Last summer, President Donald Trump revoked President Joe Biden's 2021 directive that urged federal agencies to challenge mergers that could harm consumers, reversing course from Biden's more aggressive enforcement of antitrust law. Oh, but they're flipping back. The Federal Trade Commission Chairman Andrew Ferguson called for a task force on healthcare mergers that are leading to higher prices and decreased quality of care. Yeah, I liked the challenge the merger. Let's set up a task force. Sounds more like a stall to me. Several states have stepped in to try to curb healthcare monopolies. In 2023, Minnesota passed a law banning anti-competitive healthcare mergers and bolstering state oversight. In 2022, California passed a law requiring large healthcare businesses to give the state a 90-day notice of mergers, and it created an agency to investigate their effects on competition. And Oregon passed a law in 2021 enabling the state health department to block acquisitions and mergers of hospitals. But these are whispers in the darkness. Nothing has stopped the overall trend. Hospitals seek to grow and gain leverage, increasing consolidation by insurers, which is also happening. It's like I use the metaphor of the giant sumo wrestlers getting bigger and bigger and stomping around, and it just stay out from under their feet because they take no prisoners and go where they can go. Last year, hospitals and health systems announced 46 mergers and acquisitions, 5 ranked as mega mergers, meaning they valued at more than $1 billion. One of those mega mergers merged 28 hospitals across Connecticut and New York into a powerful interstate health system. Another linked Sanford Health and Marshfield Health Clinic Systems, a deal that created a 56-hospital system across the Midwest and beyond, with a combined revenue of about $10 billion. So let's go back to Asheville and that $40,000 knee replacement. It goes way back to 1998. That's when the hospitals first figured out that in order to have leverage against the insurance companies, they needed to present a unified front because the insurance companies were trying to increase profits and ratchet down payments. So the city's two acute care hospitals, St. Joseph's and Memorial, created Mission Hospital. Now, I'm not going to tell the personal interest stories that are included in my source information here. I'm going to stick with the facts, but let's do that. Let's stick with the facts. Insurers basically are trying to make as much profit as they can. Hospitals are trying to make as much profit as they can. The profit is coming from us. The full cost for an employer to pay an average family's health insurance, for that would be like an average family of four, is $27,000. And that's a business expense. And how you multiply that by the number of employees, and that's a serious chunk of your overhead. The FTC has actually intervened in only 1% of monopoly-type mergers. In the case of Asheville, when that merger was formed, the state officials looked at that and said, hey, this would give them the power to raise prices, and they made the hospital sign an agreement to limit spending and profit margins. And the hospital behaved itself for about 20 years. And then in 2015, after much lobbying, the state legislature decided to drop the state restrictions, abandoning the profit limits. 3 years later, HCA, evil corp personified, if you ask me, the largest hospital corporation in the country, bought Mission Health. This put a prepackaged monopoly into the hands of the world's largest for-profit corporations. And let's do some price comparison. For a breast biopsy now, United Health pays $7,500 at Mission and $1,700 at Catawba. For hernia repair, it's $17,700 or $9,600. So there's no question that the Mission Hospital is leveraging their prices. They charge prices that are 333% of prices set by Medicare. The benchmark for prices is 280%. By the way, 280% of Medicare sounds really, really good to me. Doctors fight to get 85% of Medicare. In fact, if you look around locally and you notice that almost all the doctors in town work for one of two big consolidated groups, well, guess what? That's because overhead, in a word. The small doctor's offices could not manage any longer with what they were managing to pull from Medicare and insurance companies. So doctors consolidated. And now doctors, many of them, aren't really in charge of their own shop. Someone else is in charge of them, and it shows. For many patients in Asheville, the quality of the care dropped. This is consistent with academic studies showing that the quality of healthcare always declines when hospitals have little competition. And once HCA moved in, there were severe staff cuts and changes in the way care was delivered. Three times since 2024, that's a couple years after the corporate raiders moved in and started extracting shareholder value, state health inspectors working on working have issued immediate jeopardy findings, indicating problems so severe that they posed an imminent risk of serious or injury or death to patients. Imminent jeopardy findings are a non-thing at our local hospitals, I'm happy to say. Anecdotes aren't important here. What's important is that we need to regulate and limit hospital monopolies. If there are only two hospitals in a town, they probably shouldn't be allowed to merge. If they are allowed to merge, they probably shouldn't be allowed to turn from being not-for-profit to for-profit, which is just a really, really bad idea. Moving on to our second health economics story for the evening, I call this one a drop in the bucket. Big news. While overall prescription drug prices record the sharpest drop in more than 60 years, while overall medical costs continued to rise, prescription drug prices fell by 3.1% in the year ending in July, the steepest decline since 1963. Okay, woohoo, 3%. After decades of 10% increases, I can't be impressed. This is like the stock market, you know? It's up, it's down. Hey, it's up 3%. Oh, well, yesterday it was down 5%. That means it's still 2% in the hole. Hello? Things fluctuate. And in the case of drug prices, it's been a really sharply sloped upward zigzaggy curve. So what is behind this drop? Well, that's what this story is about. And as you might imagine, the White House is taking credit for this, saying President Trump's efforts to slash drug prices are working. Most experts say, well, they actually haven't started yet. A Biden-era policy that requires Medicare to negotiate prices for some popular prescription drugs is much more likely to be driving down costs. Now, prescription drugs prices have slid sharply over the last 6 months. That's almost entirely due to the price shifts around GLP-1 drugs. Let's go back a year. Spotty insurance coverage. Most people were not getting it covered by their insurance. And suddenly an entire just cottage industry of compounding pharmacies who are legally allowed to buy bulk drug powder and reconstitute it into injectable substances. Compounding pharmacies, veterinarians use them all the time. I mean, you've got the dog drug, but you've got a 4-pound dog and a 400-pound dog. You're going to need a lot of dose variability there. Plus, you've got dogs who don't like peppermint. And so you have to figure out, you have to have all these different flavorings to get the stuff to stay in the dog long enough to do the dog some good. It's the most creative aspect of pharmacy, and they're held to very high standards in terms of anything that they produce, but especially anything they produce that has to be injected. So compounding pharmacies, good. That's why a couple of weeks ago I came down in favor of allowing compounding pharmacies to make peptides, or at least a short list of peptides that haven't already proved themselves to be like horrendously bad idea, like the nasal spray that gave you nasal melanoma. But getting back to our topic, the Inflation Reduction Act was a signature accomplishment for President Biden. It was enacted in 2022, and it aimed to lower prescription drugs by requiring Medicare to bargain, to negotiate, like every other country on the planet, negotiating the prices it pays drug makers for an array of popular and costly prescription drugs. Sometimes I feel like a reverse Cassandra because, you know, Cassandra could see the future and see the possible consequences, but no one believed me. Well, I see the past, and lest we forget, what Biden was doing with the Inflation Reduction Act was partially rescinding the ridiculous George Bush administration Medicare Part D provisions that created the donut hole, which is a crazy idea, that prohibited, specifically, statutorily prohibited Medicare from bargaining, using that market leverage. You know, we were talking about hospital market leverage a minute ago. Well, there is no gorilla bigger than Medicare on the planet. Well, I don't think so anyway, in terms of its marketing leverage for drug prices. And it would destroy the drug industry if Medicare started bargaining on everything. So they just, you know, did some negotiations and, you know, some campaign contributions, probably exchanged hands. And then it kind of changed into, all right, we'll pick the 10 most commonly prescribed drugs and we'll negotiate for those. And then, you know, next year we'll pick another 10 and we'll negotiate for those. The first price reductions took place the beginning of January 2026. Now, remember, this is 2022 legislation. It takes 4 years to roll out. It finally rolls out. And in 6 months, it's estimated that it saved the taxpayers about $6 billion. So you can see how much money is to be saved by simply a market negotiation. Trump, of course, has to have a contrary plan. So he's put together, rolled out earlier this year, Trump RX. And aside from GLPs, it covers a limited number of other drugs. No generics, though, only brands, because, hey, you want the quality stuff, right? Another Trump policy that's out there is something called most favored nation pricing, which ties U.S. prices to the lower ones paid abroad. This has not gone into place yet, so they can't use that for credit. Let's talk about those statistics. Are they any good? Well, the Bureau of Labor Statistics category for prescription drugs does not track what drug companies charge. It tracks how much a pharmacy actually receives from the insurer plus the patient when it fills a prescription. In other words, the consumer price. That means it includes your copay and whatever discounts and drug reimbursements your insurance company covers. And of course, it will vary depending upon whether you're in your deductible phase. So the price is never really the price, is it? So it's pretty hard to actually get good data on this. A drop in this index may mean that people have switched to Medicare. and lost their insurance, which is, we have an aging population. A certain amount of the drop in the price probably is due to that. And of course, we've got generics. When a brand name loses patent protection, this is interesting. I did not know this. The Bureau of Labor Statistics waits about 6 months and then swaps the brand in its sample that's its proprietary to a generic and records the difference as a reduction in price. And a wave of blockbuster drugs that were exclusive lost their exclusivity over the past year. So that may also be pushing the index down. So it's good news. I like the trend line here. I think it will continue, and I'm very happy about that. But we have to become better consumers. We have to become smart buyers. I think we're generally pretty good about cars. You know, we shop, we check independent reports, with what drugs you use, you certainly do have the ability to go looking for cheaper sources of drugs, particularly generic drugs. And so I just want to put in, and I'm not receiving payment, I don't get payment from anybody. So the Mark Cuban Cost Plus and the GoodRx, those are go-tos. When you get told that your copay for something is $50 and you look it up on GoodRx, and the cash pay with coupon is $15, you're being scammed, either by your insurance company, by the pharmacy benefit manager, or by the pharmacy. Probably by all three, because they're probably all three owned by the same company, which is another problem, a hidden sort of vertical monopoly. And there's a bunch of those lurking in our healthcare system, and they're, you know, things bought and sold all the time, and you create these alliances where essentially you raise your overhead, which is great because you're paying another company that increased price, and maybe their profits are low enough that they stay below the Obamacare 15% limit on profit. And so essentially, instead of a 15% limit, it's like a 30% limit if you play your books right. The price is not the price. This is a crazy market. And we really, really, really need to do something about it. What's the old phrase? Ah, yes. We're eating our seed corn. We are allowing our institutions to degenerate. We are allowing our workforce. We're overworking our workforce. And we are destroying the willingness that people have to actually enter this sector and stay in it. It looks good till you're there. We can't do this. We have to turn this around, and it's not going to be easy, and it's actually that disclosure of the hospital prices, that's a first step. I think disclosure of prices in general, so that people can shop, so that they can make good decisions and have some bargaining leverage. Hey, all those web developers out there, all those people who are trying to develop apps, here's a really good place to develop some consumer-facing apps that allow people to be savvy consumers of healthcare. Let's say my breast biopsy. If I knew my breast biopsy was going to come out of my pocket, and I knew if I drove an hour to the next big town, it would cost me maybe $4,000 less. I'd make the drive if I knew. So let's get that information where people can access it. I am calling you, all of you web developers and app developers out there. This can't be that hard. Find the data, harness it, give it to us so we can see it, and let us be smart again. I promised you a scary story, a disturbing tale of dormant tumor cells. I think it's worth jumping into this. Don't worry, there is a ray of hope at the end of this, but we are going to describe a reality that most of us don't think about and that has still got pushback from some elements in the medical community, although I think given there's a bunch of commercial tests out there collecting $1,000 or more to put this information in the hands of consumers, some big venture capital folks thought that the data was good enough to invest in. I understand that the big money people are the ones to follow in these matters. Dormant tumor cells are out there in your bloodstream before a tumor is even diagnosed. Before it's diagnosed, it's highly probable that it has already seeded itself in remote locations. Today we'll discuss what science is learning about dormant tumor cells. Researchers have found that dormant cells leave a primary tumor early in a cancer's progression, quite often before the disease has been diagnosed. How and why these cells break away isn't entirely clear, but after spending just minutes in circulation, they exit the bloodstream and concentrate in certain parts of the body. They like the bone marrow, they like lymph nodes. Even in these niches, these dormant cells are extremely rare, maybe just a handful among millions of healthy cells. And they're in a state of suspended animation that shields them from conventional treatments, such as chemotherapy, that target rapidly dividing cells, and also many of the monoclonal biologics that target metabolism in other ways. They're targeting tumor metabolism, but if the tumors aren't metabolizing, or the cancer cells, rather, aren't metabolizing, you're not going to find them. Petros Santolis, a medical oncologist at the University of Geneva in Switzerland, says that dormancy differs from other known states like senescence. In senescence, old cells stop dividing as they're preparing to die. Given the right conditions, dormant cells can begin dividing anew, and once reawakened, dormant cells multiply into tumors that replicate the full complexity of the original tumor. After all, it was all there in the DNA. This has led some researchers to suggest that dormant tumor cells might be a kind of cancer stem cell, a type of cell that through renewal and differentiation might give rise to the tumor, or that should, or at least they might be cancer cells with stem cell-like features. And they have some characteristics that are commonly associated with stem cells, such as the overexpression of certain genes seen in stem cells, and behavior as well. Stem cells in our body, such as our bone marrow stem cells, spend most of their time dormant. When you talk about organ stem cells in the liver, let's say, they only wake up after there's been an injury. Think about your skin. Your stem cells are in there, but when you cut yourself, they're like, whoa, wake up, alarm bell, and they start dividing and they turn into fibroblasts and they migrate to the wound and start laying down tissue. Because stem cells only wake after an injury or an illness, it makes sense, especially since some of the emerging data about dormant cells suggests that they come out of dormancy after a certain stressor. It's still argued that there are cancer stem cells, but that the dormant cells can hibernate and engage in physiologic mechanisms that help them not die, even though they're not really metabolizing very much. It's really interesting stuff. It's now possible to identify and isolate and actually enrich tumor cells into what would effectively be a cell culture. And so one team is developing an assay to identify the presence of dormant cells, and it's much more sensitive than existing approaches, so it might actually be able to tell you how many people harbor dormant cells, which would be great. But these cells are a puzzle. You might expect that if it was a breast cancer stem cell, it would retain its breast cancer characteristics, but when it ends up in the bone marrow, it actually changes its shape, its size, and it starts behaving like the surrounding cells, even though it just wants to look like them. It's kind of able to camouflage itself. And the dormancy, many people think, is because the cancer cells broke off. They weren't really intended to do that. They fall off into the nascent blood vessels, perhaps, get into the system, narrowly escape being eaten by the macrophages and the other immune cells, the killer, the NK cells and such, that are in there kind of spoiling for a fight, looking for trouble, patrolling the bloodstream. They get out into the bloodstream, escaping, you know, out the exit, and look for a place to hide. And then it's a pretty tough run, and they're tired, and they put themselves to sleep, and they enter autophagy. So they actually eat themselves. Autophagy is, you know, getting rid of your dead and broken proteins. Well, they do that just, I'm thinking of what a bear does when a bear goes into hibernation. Hibernation is tough, but they build up a lot of fat, and then they very, very slowly metabolize that at a very low level, low body temperature and et cetera, and get through the winter. And you only do that when you live in an extreme environment where you're otherwise going to starve to death. While they're asleep, these cells actually monitor the environment, and that is key because they are aware at a certain level of what's going on around them, and they respond. And recent data seems to show that the immune system itself is able to exploit this. One team in New York has shown that macrophages, a type of giant amoeba immune cell in the lungs, actually produce a particular protein that binds to the dormant breast cancer, to dormant breast cancer cells, and keeps them dormant, reinforcing dormancy. There, there, Cyclops, go back to sleep. Just la la la. Yes, go back to sleep. That's right. Stay dormant. And most cells remain dormant until the immune landscape is disrupted, and it shifts the balance. Maybe the immune cells go running off to fight an infection, and the dormant cells recognize that and say, "Hey, it's our chance. Wake up, start dividing. Let's become a cancer." COVID-19 and influenza infections seem to be triggers for cancer recurrence. Certain other illnesses, all the sorts of things that you might expect, and also aging, chronic stress. We see definitely increased cancer in people who are caretakers. There's breast cancer data on adult women taking care of high needs, you know, adult children, and it's very clear that their cancer risks are greater. The immune system makes a difference here. Chronic stress and your lifestyle choices. So one of the things I wanted to emphasize when we got to lifestyle choices here is that you're talking, if you've had cancer in your life, if you've been cured of cancer in your life, that's wonderful. But you're talking to any dormant cells that might be listening. And so you want to do all of the good things. Minimal to no alcohol. Dr. Don says 5 cups of green tea a day, because ECGC found in green tea actually has strong go to sleep, Cyclops, don't wake up kind of behavior in cell culture. So yeah, we think that works. A Mediterranean diet, always, always the best strategy when you're saying, what should I eat? Well, reducing heart disease and cancer sounds like a plan. Definitely sounds like a plan to me. Okay, we have a call coming in. I'm going to pick that call right up. Hello, you're on the air on Ask Dr. Hey, Don.
Hello. I have a response to healthcare, quote, insurance.
Okay.
In as much as I'm on Medicare, I think I pay around $180 a month for Medicare, but the supplemental, which covers the last 20%, cost me $287.
Right.
I don't understand how they can only be responsible for that. But that's one thought. And there's a company that advertises through multiple venues, and they say health care is a human right. No, I disagree with that. I think health care is a societal right. And as people start to realize that you're going through school to get where you are right now cost you a ton of money. I think single payer, not Medicare for all, but single payer is the way to go, which most countries do. It's one of those things where how can a CEO of a healthcare, quote, healthcare company, how can they make seven figures when they don't really do that much? They aren't responsible for where they steer their company. And if something goes wrong with how their company is going, they don't get prosecuted. I think they should be at the top of the list for prosecution when things go awry. And you can probably tell I don't have much faith in the false notion that these companies are healthcare companies. They are hospital management and other things like that. But that's just my opinion on quote insurance.
I would first of all say thank you for your testimony, because I agree with many of your points. I did want to elaborate a little bit on the Medigap insurance, and uh-huh. that would be that $200 and something that you're paying every month.
Uh-huh.
So if you were to think about a $100,000 medical bill,
mm-hmm.
that is absolutely possible that you might end up with. My husband's medical bill for the treatment of his multiple myeloma, the actual charges related to that were upwards of $1 million. And
wow.
So now 20% of that is $200,000. And so Medicare would have, we had good insurance and we got through this quite intact, but that is not what happens with most people. And the point I want to make is that $200 a month, which is $2,400 a year, is your insurance against ending up on the hook for $200,000. If you're a betting man, you absolutely are not required to have Medigap. You can just have Medicare. I have many patients who have who are taking their chances and are just straight Medicare. And if they end up with the catastrophic hospitalization, then they're going to be out $200,000. But that's not that likely. So it's a bet. So that is an option in terms of whether you get Medigap insurance, and if you get to the situation where your income drops to the point where you would qualify for Medi-Cal, you should certainly get Medi-Cal, because Medi-Cal plus Medicare covers everything. And so for those people who are, sometimes the older and very low income patients actually come out much better than the middle class seniors because of the Medi-Cal being very generous and very honorable. So there's that to consider. And statistically, you can take a look at your health. Now, of course, catastrophic illness can strike any of us, and that's why we buy insurance. I remember my dad never had, he inherited a house, so he didn't have to pay a mortgage. And he never had insurance on it. He was like, why would I, if the house burns down, then I don't have a house anymore. But why would I throw money at insurance? The concept never made sense to him. And we don't really think these things through, of course you need Medigap, everybody says so. But, think about the counterfactual. Do you really? Or are you one of those vegan joggers who never, that I've got these people with, they're not on any meds, they're 75 years old, they run every day, they're vegan, they look emaciated, but all of their numbers are great. So what can I say, except maybe they don't need to be buying, especially if you're not going to be going after catastrophic medical care. Maybe you're just kind of like, I'll just die like my grandpa did or like my dad did. You do have choices, and you could run up the debt and just be in debt and just, what are they going to do? They can't take your house in a bankruptcy for healthcare and whatever.
Good.
So, it's like they can make you make a payment if you've got any income, and there's, you know, ways to work that one. So you sound like a free thinker, and you sound like you have some anger towards the medical industrial complex, and I certainly don't blame you for that. So, you know, you could opt out on the 20% and just take your chances.
Well, I think I'm going to get them. I'm 76, and I think I'm going to get them where it hurts. That's their pocketbook, because my whole symptom complex, according to what I understand, is sliding towards multiple sclerosis.
Oh.
I've already got. I couldn't. If I was stopped by an officer and asked to do the DUI test, I couldn't do it. There's no way I can balance. Once let's say I'm in a dark hallway, I have to guide myself through the hallway with my hands on the walls. I'm losing, my vision has changed dramatically within the past year, and I had another prescription a year ago, and it's changed dramatically again. And so I'm thinking about, or for circulation, I don't have the typical pill rolling, movements, a Parkinson?
Right.
But I do have, circulations in my forearm, as well as my hands, as well as a rotational fasciculation in my head rotation. I may in fact go in and, you know, get an MRI, because I think I'm also getting a significant hypothalamic symptoms. And
it sounds to me like you've been talking to Dr. Chat GPT in terms of your conclusions on what this may mean. Because basically, if you search your symptoms, you'll get an uninformed differential. And so I'm going to give you some prompt advice, you know, because the old garbage in, garbage out adage with computers, when you're working with an AI, you have to understand that the AI has some biases to start with, and it wants to appear smart. It wants to be authoritative. It wants, when you are looking for symptoms, it wants to give you the widest variety of possible things that could even remotely fit this. And it's like a first-year medical student. We all give ourselves leukemia and multiple sclerosis.
You've all got the disease.
Well, it's like twitching. Oh, I've got that. Oh, and I've got these little red bumps. Oh, my goodness, I've got cancer. And you do that to yourself psychologically.
Yeah.
The AI is doing something a little different. But prompt advice, and I don't mean advice that comes quickly, is that you want to specify that the list of possible diseases be listed by probability based on its frequency in the population. Because a lot of times you'll get, well, this fits best with multiple sclerosis, or this fits best with ALS, or this fits, and that's learned. But if you're once you get to the fourth or fifth year of your medical training, you realize that common things are common, rare things are rare. And so if you see something weird and it fits this rare disease, it's probably not that disease. It's probably an atypical presentation of a common disease, because that's just how probability works. So I want you to definitely, it sounds to me like you have definite neurologic stuff going on. This could be related to multiple sclerosis. If it's symmetric, it's probably not multiple sclerosis. So if you're getting the same thing on both sides, that's kind of a negative. The AI doesn't say that, but that's true. And you wouldn't, it wouldn't ask you, but I'll just mention that as a counterfactual here. I want to emphasize that I'm not telling you to ignore this. I really do think you need to follow up. I would be looking at something that's either electrolytes, so an abnormality in your blood where you've got too much calcium, maybe. That could give you a lot of neurologic symptoms because it affects the functioning of nerves. So that'd be one that would come up because that's common, you know. So I'm like, okay, this is a weird set of symptoms. The loss of balance and the loss of vision, particularly the change in your vision, is significant. And yes, that could be optic neuritis, but there's a lot of other things that could be going on. And
yeah.
You need somebody who knows what they're doing to really look in the back of your eyeball. So I would first go to someone who is skilled who can examine you, if you can possibly manage that without waiting 6 months for a first patient neurology office visit. But, when we go straight for the scan, then we're going to find stuff that has absolutely nothing to do with your symptoms, but might mean something. And then we go down the road of, oh, we see a cyst in the greater colliculus nuclei. So now we're going to need to do a biopsy of that because it could be cancer. And so now they're sticking a needle in your brain, and you were in there because you couldn't see. And, you know, that's it can be a runaway train. So imaging should not be the first place you go, because it will definitely lead you down the primrose path if you don't already have a good, solid physical examination. And so try to get a neurology exam. Do you have a primary care doctor?
No, I don't. Okay. And that's a problem.
That is, that means you don't have an advocate inside the system. Thank you for calling. It was a very interesting conversation. I'm sure our listeners enjoyed watching how that evolved.
Yes.
All right.
Okay. Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Well, that's about all for this week's podcast. Please go to AskDrDawn.com for news about our future plans. For now, this is Dr. Dawn saying so long and stay healthy.
Ask Dr. Dawn is brought to you by Jiva Media. Production and editing by Charles Bansky. Music by John Scoville.